listening to a download from the outdoorstation.co.uk. Number 425.
Hello and welcome back to the Outdoor Station. On this very grey, dull winter's day in Old Blighty. It's the kind of day one spends finding excuses to not go out at all, if you can help it. Maybe you start to look through old outdoor magazines or the internet to find a walking adventure to inspire you. Of course, somewhere warm. As I mentioned last week, I'm off to the Adventure Travel Show tomorrow, as it happens, to see what offerings there are in Olympia which fit the bill. As such, I haven't really had time to organise an interview this week, so I thought I'd go back through the archives to find something warming, which you may have missed if you're a recent listener. So digging through them, I found this beauty. In April 2009, yes, 2009, I did this two-part interview with Shirley Worrell, who had recently completed the GR20 in Corsica. I know it's a popular walk many wish to undertake, so I thought I'd relaunch it to see if it helps you get over these damp doldrums. I've combined both parts into one extended podcast to save you having to find it deep down in the archives. Of course, there's plenty more down in the dirty, dusty digital cellar if you ever want to find more exciting stuff to listen to. Now, it was 2009 when this was recorded, so you need to double-check yourself as to the current prices and any changes to some of the information provided. So let's wind back the clock to those pre-Brexit days of 2009. Hello and welcome back to part one of a very special two-part podcast here at the Outdoor Station. 100 miles south of the French coast and 50 miles west of the Italian coast lies a rocky massif in the Mediterranean Sea, known as Corsica. Although its highest peaks only reach 8,858 feet, they hold snow for much of the year. And despite the Mediterranean location and the beautiful sandy beaches, the mountains are renowned for sudden and violent changes of weather. It is home to one of the finest and toughest high-level long-distance Grande Randonnée walks, totalling 118 miles in length, and affectionately known by walkers around the world as the GR20. There are numerous books written about it. Probably the most well-known is published by Cicerone Press and written by Paddy Dillon. However, books are one thing, and a passionate storyteller is entirely another. Shirley Worrell is well known on various forums as P. Wiglet, and she undertook the GR20 in the summer of 2008. And with the walk being at the top of most UK and European hikers' to-do list, she's very kindly taken time to chat with me about her experience and all it entailed. So in this part one, I started off by asking her a very, very simple question. Did she enjoy it?
Well, I had an absolutely fantastic time. I suppose that my overwhelming feeling was, well, one of exhaustion. It took my knees literally months to recover from the sort of daily assault on the very steep downhills. But I was overwhelmed by the beauty of the place. I'd been wanting to go to Corsica for, I don't know, perhaps some 4 years or so. I'd heard things about it that made it clear to me that it was a very challenging walk in very mountainous terrain. But what I think I hadn't appreciated until I got there was just how staggeringly beautiful a place Corsica actually is. Absolutely gorgeous, fantastic views in every direction all the time, wonderful weather. One of the things that always attracts me to walking abroad is sunshine. And up in the mountains, one of the great advantages, of course, is the relative absence of biting insects. And so Corsica had all of those advantages.
The sort of amount of preparation work that you did for it then, did it take you a long time to gather the information, also the confidence to do it? I mean, you're a fairly experienced walker, so I would have thought it wouldn't have given you too much fear to approach it. But did it take time to build up that sort of dynamics to go?
Well, it's a sort of mixed experience in a sense. The actual time that I spent planning it, I confess, wasn't a lot of time at all, because I decided very much at the last moment to go. And in fact, I think having decided that I wanted to go, I set off something like 2 or 3 weeks later. And so therefore, in terms of time set aside to actually deal with the logistics of the thing, i.e. getting maps, reading books, trying to decide what stages I might do on a daily basis, I didn't spend a great deal of time doing that. But on the other hand, as I say, it's probably about 4 years since somebody first mentioned the GR20 to me, and I immediately realized that it was something I'd like to do. But I quickly learned that, the thing about the GR20 is that it has a reputation for being quite a vertiginous sort of route. It's said to be a route that involves a great deal of scrambling, and I don't consider myself to be very good at heights. Therefore, although I was keen to go, I always tried to be realistic, and I realized it was likely that I would probably go on my own. And so therefore, I have hesitated a little bit, because I didn't want to find that I was stuck up a mountain, basically, with no way of getting down. And another thing that scared me a little bit in advance of going was the knowledge that lightning can be quite a problem over in Corsica, as it can in the Pyrenees as well, but to a greater extent, I think, on Corsica. And during that 2 or 3 weeks that I spent reading up on the route before I went, I learned that lightning strike is in fact the highest cause of death on the route. And so that's something that quite seriously gave me cause to wonder whether it was the right sort of place for me. And I contacted a couple of friends, one of whom has done it, another of whom hasn't done it, but was a very experienced walker, and tossed the thing around in my mind, and eventually decided to stop whittling about, basically, and just get on with it. And now that I've been, of course, I'm delighted that I went. I did think long and hard about it, because I know that it's quite a serious undertaking, really, the GR20. It's much more demanding physically than anything that I'd done before. And facilities for people to come and rescue you if you have an accident or make a boo-boo, I think, are less readily available than they are in many of the other places that I've walked. And so, therefore, I did take it seriously, because it is a serious undertaking. And so, although in the end I only spent 2 or 3 weeks actually dotting the I's and crossing the T's before I set off, I had been thinking it over for a couple of years before I went.
All right. And which book, or is there any particular book that actually struck you as being the most useful for getting sort of accurate information, things that were really important to you?
Well, the one that I liked the best was Paddy Dillon's book, which is GR20 Corsica, the High Level Route. There's a couple of versions around, but I had what was then the most up-to-date version. I think it may still be. It's Cicerone, and it was published in April 2006. There's another book that a lot of people were carrying, and that's Corsica Trekking GR20 by David Abram, which is one of the trailblazer guides. And that's more recently published. I think it was in January of 2008. And I like the trailblazer guides, because they always include a little summary of, they have little flower pictures. And as I've grown older, I've become very fond of spending time gazing at the flowers and taking photographs. And so I appreciate those. But I have to say that I did read each of them pretty carefully, and I found that Paddy's book was the one that contained the information that I felt I was more likely to want to have on a day-to-day basis. It also has a very useful, as well as having descriptions of the sections, it's got one of those useful little sort of profiles that shows you, how much up and how much down there is involved on a daily basis. And so that I actually took it with me. I don't normally take a guidebook, but we may come onto maps later, and if we do, then I'll tell you that I didn't. Unusually, I didn't take a map, but I did take the guidebook on this occasion, and it was Paddy's book that I took.
Brilliant. So really, then, I suppose to conclude that this part of what you're saying is it's definitely a challenging walk, and it's a walk for somebody who's experienced sort of long-distance walk, should we say, not doing it as a first time long distance walk. Obviously, it sounds like it would be a little bit more of a challenge, and perhaps out of the reach of somebody just decides to do this as their first long distance walk. And the other question is, I presume this, what, 3 weeks was it? Did it take you?
Let me see. The standard is 15 days. I mean, you know how these things tend to be. It's sort of fallen into stages, and that's the way it tends to be walked. And so the standard is actually 15 days. I did it in 14 days, but that's only because, despite the fact that I'd read each of the books more than once, I somehow managed to miscount. And I kind of thought that it was 14 days rather than 15. But it's a 15-day walk. Bob, just going back just very quickly to what you were saying immediately before that, in terms of how challenging it is, I'd want to just emphasize, I mean, obviously this is subjective, but from my point of view, I think that it's significantly more challenging than anything else that I've done. Definitely wouldn't suggest that anybody should even contemplate doing it as a first walk. And more than that, I would say that even people who are fairly experienced probably wouldn't enjoy it. I don't think you would enjoy it. I wouldn't have enjoyed it if I hadn't been fairly fit when I set off to do it, because the amount of up and down each day is really very considerable. And when you chuck in the need to either be confident enough not to be frightened of scrambles, or alternatively to expose yourself to a little bit of fear and be able to get through scrambles safely, when you include that in the mix as well, it seems to me to be stepping a little bit out of the ordinary in terms of the European walks that some of us go off and do now. I've done two or three summers on the high level route in the Pyrenees, and I considered the GR20 to be significantly more challenging than that.
Before we sort of start talking about the actual route that you took and some of the key places and so on, obviously we can't mention everything, but I'll be fascinated to hear some of the stories you've got and associated with key places. The books and notes that I've read, obviously you want to take as sort of less gear as possible. Did you approach it from using all the huts as your accommodation, or did you sort of take a small tent or a bivy bag or something as a just in case, or did you mix and match both of them?
I took a tent with me. I thought quite carefully in advance about what I was going to do, because one of the things that the guidebooks suggested to me before I went was that it would in fact be possible to use the huts as both a source of accommodation and also a source of an evening meal. And of course the point was made quite correctly that if you choose to do that, then you can carry considerably less weight, because you don't have to have a tent with you. And even if you choose to take a tent or a bivy, you don't have to be carrying cooking equipment. And so therefore, I put quite a lot of thought into that in advance. I decided in the end that I was going to take a tent. And in fact, in the event, I didn't sleep in the huts on any occasion. I slept in my tent on every night. What I didn't do was take cooking equipment. And with the benefit of hindsight, I consider that to have been a mistake of epic proportions. Now, I don't know if you'd like me to sort of touch on that now, or whether that's something
you
might
please.
Like to.
Yeah, please do.
Okay. All right. Well, basically, I think, to be honest, the impression I've got is that the GR20 is one of those walks that's gaining rapidly in popularity. Having read through the guidebooks, it seems likely to me that 10 years or so ago, and perhaps even less than that, it was possible to go to the GR20 and to stay in the huts and to eat really well, very inexpensively. The impression that I've got, basically, trying to make sense of what I've read in the guidebooks and reconcile it with what I met in the huts, which is quite different, the impression I've got is that things have moved pretty rapidly over the course of the last few years, and perhaps the local people have realised that, you know, there's a source of income here that's greater than they initially imagined. And the consequence now is it's actually very expensive, it seems to me, to eat in the huts. I found, for instance, that I was being provided with something like a bowl of lentils or a bowl of pasta and then perhaps a piece of cake for, on average, 15 euros. And, of course, the rate of exchange varies. But when I was there, which was in July 2008, that was approximately £12. And I felt that £12 for literally just a bowl of pasta or a bowl of lentils and a piece of cake was pretty steep. If I'd been full after eating the bowl of lentils or pasta and the piece of cake, then I mightn't have been quite so concerned about that, because I do understand, of course, that there are logistical difficulties in getting things up the mountains. And I understand that, you know, the local people do have to make a living. But the thing is that there weren't actually even particularly generous portions. And this was a bit of a concern, really, because the walk really is quite demanding. And so obviously, if you are going to be doing a lot of uphill and downhill during the day, you know, in sort of pretty high, in heat, then you do need to be able to refuel at night. So I found that it was, I felt that it was a significant mistake to have left my cooking equipment at home. What I decided in the end that I will do if I go back is this. I think the best compromise is most of the refuges do actually provide a cooking area, a sort of self-catering cooking area where people can do their own cooking. As far as I could see, and I was only observing because, of course, I wasn't using this facility. Most of them also provide cooking pots, although I do know for a fact that they don't all provide cooking pots. But I think the best compromise is probably, in order to cut down on weight and be able to do it without breaking the bank, plan to cook your own food in the refuges. It's possible to buy food, you know, like, for instance, rice or pasta, cans of sardines and whatever else it is that people like to eat. You can buy that in the refuges in an uncooked state, and then you can cook it for yourself. And chatting with other people who were doing that, that seemed to be much less expensive. And I did notice, I think I was almost the only British person that I met while I was doing the walk. Almost everybody else was French or German or from some other part of Europe. And I noticed that I think literally without exception, all of the French people who were doing the walk were cooking in that way, or they were eating in that way. They were not paying for food in the refuges because they were considered to be too expensive. So they were buying it on a daily basis, or perhaps carrying some staples and cooking it in the refuges. So that's what I would do if I were to go back again, and I hope that I will go back again. I will also definitely be taking my stove and a mug, because I found that it's really miserable not to be able to make a drink when you first wake up in the tent in the morning. You'd have thought that I'd have learnt this by now, but it seems it's always possible to make a new mistake. So anyhow, I'll definitely be taking it for that purpose and for the odd occasion when perhaps I might be able to cook in the refuge. But eating in the refuges is expensive. I mean, breakfast, for instance, is when I was there, it was, I don't know, 7-8 euros, something like that, which is about £5. Well, it's not a fortune, but when you consider that it consists of, you know, perhaps you choose between a cup of coffee or a cup of hot chocolate, and you know that sort of Melba toast that, you know, you can get over there, and perhaps a little pot of jam. So it's pretty insubstantial. So for what it is, it's quite a lot of money. And when you multiply that by 14 or 15 stages, it's really quite a lot. Whereas, you know, you could eat, you know, very substantially on something that you just bought and cooked up in the kitchen.
Okay, so just taking that point a bit further then, if you had have taken your own stove system and pot or whatever, what is the fuel of choice? What is the what can you actually get hold of to cook with? Because that has to be the one biggest question that most people have when they go to anywhere else in mainland Europe is, what shall I cook with? Meths, you know, a wood-burning stove or some form of gas? And is the gas going to be compatible?
Well, I'll come back to wood-burning stoves in a moment. Meths, I don't know, to be honest, because I didn't look. But when I, you know, the only time that I haven't taken a stove, sadly, is when I went to Corsica. So on every other occasion, I use some kind of gas. And when I've walked in the Pyrenees, I've used, you know, the sort of blue bottles of, is it called camping gas or something like this, that they tend to have over here. And I found that it's possible to get a little converter that just screws onto the top of the camping gas bottles. And then I can use it with my British stove. I use a Primus Micron because it's very small and very light, but there are other similar things that work just as well. And so that's what I would do. I did see people using camping gas. So like I say, I mean, you can either use the stoves that are available in the kitchens, you know, the sort of, you know, just like an ordinary cooker, industrial things that are available for communal use in the kitchens. Or if you wanted to cook in your tent or make a drink in the morning in your tent, then you can use the camping gas and use a converter. I've no doubt that it might be possible to buy some kind of spirits as well, but I just am afraid I have no idea about that because I've never tried to do that over there. As for the wood-burning stoves, now see, I've never used a wood-burning stove, but I know that you are keen on them. I've spoken to Andy Howell about them. I know he's very keen on them. And I've watched a few videos on YouTube, and they do look pretty exciting. And it might be that a wood-burning stove would be an option. There are certainly lots of little bits and pieces of dead trees that have been struck by lightning. I wasn't paying close enough attention to notice whether it would be possible on the average day to gather enough wood to be able to cook by. But I wouldn't be surprised if it was. So you'd probably have to ask somebody who'd taken a proper look. But as a matter of principle, that might be a possibility.
Okay. And do you actually pass through enough villages to pick up some provisions and gas or whatever else? Or are you totally reliant on whatever the hut can provide?
Well, you're almost completely reliant upon what the huts can provide. In terms of villages, really, you start out at a place called Calanzana, And then, hang on a sec, I have to remind myself. Then I think I'm right in saying you don't then actually get into a village as such until what's approximately the midway point, which is a place called Visavona, which is a very small village, but it feels like a thriving metropolis in comparison with what you've passed through before. But I mean, essentially, the walk is broken into two halves, the northern part and the southern part. And I think most people probably walk it north to south, which is what I did, although, you know, a significant minority of people go south to north. But I think that there are probably more people doing half of the route than there are doing the whole route at any one time. And so in either one of those halves, you're not going to be going through villages on a daily basis, as you might do, you know, if you were walking along the Pyrenees, or if you were walking in this country along something like the Pennine Way or the Coast to Coast or the West Highland Way. It isn't like that. I mean, it really is a mountain walk where you're just walking from refuge to refuge. And the refuges do have supplies of things that you can buy. I mean, as I say, you can buy staples. I didn't pay a great deal of attention because I wasn't buying them, but because I'm always hungry, I did notice that they were selling things like pasta and rice and cans of sardines and so on and so forth. And some refuges, of course, had supplies that were more extensive than those available at other refuges. So you can get that kind of thing, but I wouldn't like to rely upon the possibility of being able to get hold of camping gas at any particular stage. I mean, as I say, I didn't take the stove, and so therefore I didn't actually have to look into it in any detail. But before I go back, I will look more carefully and make some inquiries to try to find out where it might be possible to get the camping gas. Because if it isn't available at the refuges, then I suppose that it would be necessary to wait for Visavona. And to be perfectly honest, I'm not even absolutely sure that you would expect to get it there.
Mm. OK, well, I think that's probably one of the most interesting sections, really, to do with this particular route, because it's something that's always plays on my mind. And I know on a lot of people's mind who've spoken to me and asked me about different places is the fuel and the cooking issues. And obviously then, as you quite rightly say, the balancing with the actual staple diet as well, because that food is the most heavy thing that we carry, of course. But let's actually move on to the walk itself. This is going really well. Obviously, you did it in 14 days. Congratulations!
Thank you.
I saw a bit of a talk from Paddy Dillon not so long back, and he was suggesting that when people first arrive, they spend sort of 24 hours acclimatizing themselves to the fact that it is a warm Mediterranean part of the world. Did you do that? Where did you actually fly to, and did you sort of take time before you actually started it, as it were?
Okay, well, I suppose perhaps almost inevitably. Now, I didn't actually take the advice to do the acclimatising because I seem to have a habit of kind of deciding at the last moment to go off and do things. But no, what I did was, in the 2 or 3 weeks available to me to decide whether I was going, and if indeed I was, then how I was getting there, I did quite a lot of research on the internet into how I might get there, and I discovered that you can fly directly to Corsica from London, and I think probably also from Manchester, but it's relatively expensive to do that. Probably, I don't know, last year I think it was probably something like £450 return or something like that. When I looked around, I found that it was possible to break it into two parts. And so what I did is I flew with EasyJet from Liverpool to Nice. And I think that I left Liverpool at about 7:15 in the morning and got to Nice at something like 10:30 in the morning. And then I spent, the late morning and early to mid-afternoon in Nice. And then I got a second flight, this time with Air France, from Nice to Calvi, which is one of the airports on Corsica. And then at Calvi, I did take Paddy Dillon's advice, which was to flag down a taxi and jump in and ask to be taken to the youth hostel. Well, I'm not sure the youth hostel, the refuge, at Calanzana, which is the start point. So that's how I did it. And I found that was literally half as expensive. It cost me approximately £200 return for those flights. And the taxi to Calvi was approximately €30 in one direction. From Calvi, to Calanzana cost approximately €30. So that's how I did it. And I arrived at, I'm just trying to think what time I actually got to Calanzana. I suppose that it was early evening, perhaps 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock, something like that. And basically, I wandered over to reception, paid, I think it was €4 or something very inexpensive to put up my tent, and put up my tent and then just nipped up the road quickly. I'd been told by somebody that there was a spa shop up the road, and I managed to get there just in time to buy some sort of basic lunch supplies that I were going to carry me through the next few days. And then I wandered around the village and found somewhere to have dinner. There were several restaurants, and I chose the one that looked good because I could eat outside, and I did. And then I went back to the tent and basically slept, and the following morning I set off. So I suppose that I spent several hours in Nice, so in that way, you know, I sort of had time to ease into the fact that I was, you know, not working and I was now on holiday, but I didn't have a day to wander around and get used to the climate or anything like that.
But I suppose by the sound of it, you've managed to unwind in that wonderful way that when you do get away from Liverpool or wherever, that by the time end up in a place like this, a glass of wine and a nice meal and a bit of sunshine as you watch the sun go down always does help the old temperament, doesn't it?
Oh, definitely. Mm.
So you set off the following day. Is it an early start to get going?
It is an early start. I'd heard in advance that many people start walking at what seemed to me to be crazy hours in the morning. I'd heard that some people will start out at 5 a.m. and quite commonly people will leave at 6 or 7. And I'm not very good at getting up early and I'm pretty slow in the morning, so I was a little bit concerned about that. But I found that I soon slipped into the routine. Basically, people do tend to set off early in the morning. I found that as the walk went on, I was commonly leaving, you know, setting off for the day's walk at something like 7 a.m., something like that. So I suppose that means that I was waking at 6 or possibly, you know, sometime between 5:30 and 6 a.m. and getting off at 7. And the main reason that people do that, of course, is that the heat builds up quite rapidly, you know, during the course of the morning. And I mentioned lightning earlier on and the dangers of lightning strike. And although I'm certainly no expert on climate, I do understand that as the day goes on, you're more likely to encounter those storms. And so, therefore, it's a good idea to try to get the walk out of the way before the storm clouds gather and storms containing lightning begin to happen, you know, in the mid-afternoon. So that's one of the two reasons that people tend to make an early start. The second reason that people tend to make an early start is that those people who want to stay in the refuges as opposed to camp outside, I've heard that they like to sort of nip off as quickly as possible to be sure that they can get a place for the following night. I don't know whether anybody encountered any difficulty getting a place while I was doing the walk, because as I mentioned earlier, I wasn't actually sleeping in the refuges, but I certainly read I think probably in Paddy's book and possibly also in David Abrams' book, and definitely in accounts that I've read on the web, that later in the season it can become very busy in the refuges, and so people, you know, are basically racing each other from one refuge to another to make sure getting a place. For those who are camping, as I was, the only sort of advantage other than that involved in avoiding the lightning is of getting the pick of the camping spots, because I found when I got to the refuges, there are camping areas outside each of the refuges. The ground over there was very different from any ground that I'd ever camped on before. It's baked clay, essentially, and it's extremely hard. And what they tend to do is they tend to section off the ground into little sort of emplacements or emplacements or something like this, each one of these being, you know, sufficient for one tent. And so it's not, as it might be over here, you know, a big green field or a muddy field where you just sort of pick a spot and put the tent down. You know, you look for these prearranged places. You know, they might be marked off with rocks, for instance, or little bits of wood, nothing more formal than that. But it's very obvious when you look, you know, this is where you're supposed to put the tent, and that's not where you're supposed to put the tent. And an advantage, of course, when you're camping, of getting off early is you can have the pick of the places, the places where you might wish to put your tent. But I mean, essentially, the whole place is so beautiful that it doesn't really make an enormous difference. All the places are lovely, but it's always nice to have the pick of the bunch when it comes choosing where to put the tent up.
Yeah. Now, what's the actual legal situation as regards, you know, wild camping, if you got either caught short or if the campsite and the refuge was full? Presumably you've got to camp somewhere else. Is that possible?
Well, it's possible to put up the tent somewhere illegally, but it isn't allowed. It's a national park and wild camping isn't allowed at all. I didn't actually see anybody doing it. Although I did, on one day, speak to a couple who were walking in the other direction. We met at some refuge or other and sat around chatting over a can of Corsica Cola, I think it was called. And they told me that they had, in fact, put up their tent. I can't remember whether it was the night before or whether it was a little bit earlier in the journey, but they did put up their tent one night in some particularly scenic spot rather than outside a refuge. And they said that the following day, when they arrived at the next refuge, the guardian was onto this immediately and very suspicious and said to them, well, where did you stay last night? Because if you'd stayed at, you know, the refuge before this, then you shouldn't be here by now because it takes longer than this to get here. And I can't remember what excuse they gave him, but definitely they needed to mollify him. So it isn't allowed. I don't know what consequences might follow if they definitely caught a person out while camping. But of course, the reality is that, I mean, if you were to have an accident or something, then it's always physically possible to put the tent up next to the path.
Right, well, coming back to the actual trip itself then, you were obviously following the days as marked out in Paddy's book or which the book you took with you. How did the walk unwind, as it were? Do you sort of hit a steep climb to start off with, and there's a long pull, or does it gently build up to some serious climbs?
Well, you jump in pretty much at the deep end, basically. If you walk north to south, as most people do, and as I did, then you very much jump in at the deep end. I think I mentioned earlier on that a lot of people will be walking only either the north or the south part. And although they're both sides of the walk are demanding, I think everybody would agree that the north is the more demanding of the two routes. It's rockier and there's more up and down. And quite a lot of people would also say, I think, that perhaps the first day is the most challenging of all the days on the route. The first day goes from Calanzana to, and I won't even attempt to try to pronounce this because I just can't, but it's Refuge Dortu Diu Piobu or something like this. But anyhow, it's the standard stage for the first day. It's about 20 kilometers. And basically, it's uphill all the way. There's absolutely no downhill at all. So it really is pretty exhausting. And it's hot as well. I went at the beginning of July, and I deliberately chose to go at the beginning of July because it seemed likely to be the first part of the season when I wasn't likely to encounter snow. I mean, you can still have snow in July. Then again, you know, you might find that there's no snow in June, according to what I've read. But you know, the beginning of July seemed to be the best compromise. And the worst of the lightning storms occur later in the season. And as I've mentioned a couple of times already, I was very keen to avoid them. So that's why I went at the beginning of July. But although it was early in the season, it was still hot. And so, yes, you jump in very much at the deep end with the first day, 20 kilometres, and it's just up, 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 up all the way. After that, the pattern that most days seem to take is that there will be a very steep ascent followed by an extremely steep descent. The ground underneath it's very rocky, and as I say, it does tend to be steep. I find that, I mean, we're all different in the way in which we walk, but I'm immediately reaching for the table so that I can touch wood, to encounter too much difficulty going uphill. I find that uphill's not normally too much of a problem to me. But as my knees grow older, I find that I do encounter difficulties doing steep downhills, carrying weights. And my knees get really very painful. I never do any walking now without pacer poles, and so therefore I do have those to rely upon. But I found that even with the pacer poles, you know, some of the downhills were really very, very challenging and actually pretty miserable, basically. You know, at times I'd sort of have to sit down and take a deep breath and have a little sip of my water. And, well, sadly, I was smoking then. I've managed to chuck it in again since that time. But I'd sit down and have a cigarette and ponder on how much longer it was going to take me to get down to the refuge at the bottom of the hill. So, yes, each day tends to sort of fall very naturally into a very steep uphill, followed by a very steep downhill, more than any other kind of route that I've done so far.
So if you were starting around sort of 7-ish each day, what sort of time were you arriving at your destination? About to what, 6, 7 again?
Oh, no, very early, really, because, well, not too long after lunch, in fact, because I suppose the advantage of starting early is, of course, that, you know, you're going to finish pretty early as well. And it wasn't uncommon to finish the walk at something like 1 or 2 o'clock. I mean, I'm just glancing here at the list of distances that I made. And most of the days are not actually awfully long, and some of them are very short in terms of distance covered, although they still feel pretty challenging because the amount of up and downhill involved. But, I mean, for instance, the first day, you know, going by the stages that people normally walk, the first day is 20 kilometers, but the second day is only 8 kilometers. And the third day, this seems incredible to me, in fact, now that I'm looking at it, but the third day is only 6 kilometers. And then we go to 9, 15, 17, 10, 11, 13, 24, and so on. So day 2 and day 3 and 4 at 8, 6, and 9, I mean, they're very short in comparison with the other ones, but they still managed to feel pretty challenging because of the sort of ground that was being covered. And I suppose that it must have been the case that I see that day 3, it was the day that I finished at a place that's called Hort Asko. And I think that I did get there, I don't know, what, 12 or 1 or something very early. But most days we probably finished at something like 2 o'clock.
Right. And I suppose, of course, as you arrive earlier, these refugees are there. The temptation is to spend money, isn't there, to occupy your time and also treat yourself?
Yeah, it is. And of course, I always like to treat myself to, well, I like to treat myself to a beer, essentially, is what I like to treat myself to first. And of course, it's not hugely expensive, but it's quite expensive in comparison with how it would be here. I mean, for instance, beer, again, in July of last year, a beer was generally about €5. You could get a Coke or another soft drink, that would be about €3.50. But it's still, what's that, like £4? Almost £3 for a beer or for a Coke. And I noticed that a lot of the people who were doing the walk didn't treat themselves. They were really quite strict. You know, as I say, there were a lot of, you know, people who were there from France or Germany who were cooking in the refuges, and they were clearly doing it on a tight budget. And I think you do need to be careful in order to be able to do this walk on a tight budget, because otherwise it can quite easily become an expensive walk.
I just interrupt you there? Yeah, just I just suddenly thought, I mean, I am presuming, obviously, that these huts only took cash as well, didn't they?
Well, I think that must be so. I didn't attempt to pay at a hut with anything other than cash, and I'm sure that they will only take cash. I did pay with a card twice, but on both occasions they were at hotels. I mentioned that Visavona is a sort of village that's more or less in the middle, and I treated myself to a hotel there, and they took a card. I did try to get some cash out against my card the following morning. I hadn't run out, but, you know, there's always the feeling that it might be nice to have a little bit extra as a reserve, so I thought I'd get some if I could. But it wasn't possible. I mean, it may be possible next year or the year after, but it wasn't possible last year. And at Konka, which is the end of the walk, I stayed in a hotel there, and they also allowed me to pay with a card. But otherwise, I think it would have to be cash. And also in relation to that, and this is a point that Paddy makes in his guidebook, and I'm really glad I noticed, you can't get cash along the way because you're not walking through villages, and because, as I say, well, the hotel that I stayed at in Visavona didn't allow me to take money out. You can't get it along the way, and you definitely do need to take it with you. It's absolutely essential that you take it with you. So anybody who's planning to do it, you really do need to think very hard about how much money you're going to need and make sure that you've got it. And I would say, on the side of caution, if you can, take a little bit extra. You can always chuck it back in the bank when you get home, because you can't resupply en route as you can almost everywhere else.
Well, with that comment in mind, Cheryl, I mean, 2008, how much cash were you actually carrying with you, if you don't mind me asking?
No, I took €800 with me, and I was thinking, and so of course I'd already paid for the flights, but the €800 was for everything else, you know, the taxis to and from Calvi and the refuges, the food and the beers and whatever else I might come across. And that was enough, but having said that, because I did like to have a beer in the evening and occasionally two beers or maybe a beer and a hot chocolate or something like that, I mean, I can't say I came home with tons of cash. I can't actually remember now whether I brought anything back, but if I did, it wouldn't have been a great deal. Now, I know it would have been possible to spend less than that if, as I say, I'd actually bought raw food, as it were, and cooked it in the refuges. But because I wasn't doing that, because I was sort of reliant upon eating in the refuges, you know, I was spending, let's say, 15 euros for dinner. I mean, it all mounts up. Let's say 15 euros for dinner, add on 5 for a beer, so you're at 20. If you're going to have breakfast, that's another 8, let's say, so that's 28. And if you want a hot chocolate too, well, let's say that's, I don't know, let's say that's bringing it up to about 30 euros. It's easy to spend 30 euros a night if you're eating in the refuges, and it would be pretty easy to spend more than that, but it's very easy to spend 30 euros a night, and when you multiply it by 15, you can see how it kind of mounts up.
Certainly soon adds up. And obviously you mentioned it, or you've implied it, that certainly the other Europeans, as it were, that were doing the trip, was the general conversation that it's getting very expensive to do? Did they feel the pinch?
Well, I think that is what people felt. I mean, I immediately have to sort of add the caveat that conversation was in French, and my French is not terribly sophisticated, but I do try, and certainly we did try to talk. And I think that the feeling was, you know, that it's quite an expensive trip. And those people, you know, the people that I chatted with, who there were a few people who were doing the whole thing, who started on the same day as me. And so, you know, inevitably you get to sort of recognize the familiar faces, and we'd sort of chat when we could in the evenings when language allowed. Unless I've misunderstood them, they did seem to feel that it was expensive, and they indicated that the reason that they were eating, you know, cooking their own food and camping in a tent as opposed to eating in the refuge and sleeping in the refuge is because they were trying to save money on it. My language skills were not sophisticated enough to learn whether they felt that it had become more expensive in recent years than it had been. I mean, I don't know about that, but that's definitely the impression I've got from having read, you know, Paddy's book, and looked in David's book, and read what other people have said before. I think that it must have become significantly more expensive, you know, in fairly recent years, basically.
And on that note, we draw part one of these podcasts to a close, and hope you return to join us again for part two, which will be available very soon. For more information about Shirley's GR20 trip and others she has made, do visit her website for photos, detailed information, and a lot of outdoor inspiration. Her website is www.pwiglet.com, and you spell that pwiglet.com. So until next time, folks, safe travels, high peaks, happy hiking, and bye for now. Every month, we're holding a special competition where you can win some fabulous outdoor gear. It's a great way to support the Outdoor Station. The more entries we get, the better the future prizes. During the month of January 2017, the prize is a top-of-the-range outdoor sleeping set. This includes the lightest three-season backpacking mat, the NeoAir X-Lite Regular, a luxurious 100% premium silk sleeping bag liner, and a practical lightweight pillow sack. The total weight of all these items is only 526 grams, and the combined value is £180. Simply answer the following question and text in your A, B or C answer before the closing date of the 31st of January, and you will be automatically entered. You can enter a maximum of 5 times from the same UK registered mobile phone number. So this month's question is, in the fairy tale Sleeping Beauty, the princess is brought back from the curse of endless sleep by a kiss from A, a frog, B, a donkey, or C, a prince.
To be in with a chance of winning, all you have to do is text OUTDOORS and your answer of A, B or C to 82055, or post your answer with your name and contact phone number to Competition, The Outdoor Station, PO Box 924, Worcester, WR4 4GB. Entries are open to anyone aged 16 plus, and you must have the bill payer's permission. Texts cost £1 plus your standard network rate, and the competition closes at the end of each month. Entries received after that date will not count, but you may still be charged. The winner will be contacted within 3 days of the competition closing, and they may appear in future programmes. For full rules plus terms and conditions, please go to theoutdoorstation.co.uk/competitions.
Continuing on from part one, where we discussed some of the costs involved in doing this walk, did she think it represented good value for money?
Well, I mean, in a way, it was good value for money because it was an absolutely fabulous experience. I mean, it was a fantastic experience. And I mean, you might be a bit like me in that suddenly, I suppose, I tend to come back from walks where I've had a great time and think, oh, my God, it's the best walk I've ever had. It was absolutely fantastic. And, you know, I mean, I've had that feeling before. But really, Corsica was truly wonderful. I mean, everything about it was absolutely wonderful. And so, really, when I consider that I went away for 2.5 weeks and had that sort of experience that I'll never forget, and it cost me less than £1,000, then I'd have to say that, yes, it was good value for money. But it's more expensive than walking in the Pyrenees. It's more expensive than walking in the Pyrenees. Having said that, I'm not sure that it's more expensive than walking in England, because, of course, if you want to go off and do the coast to coast, as I've done several times, and stay in B&Bs, then that gets very expensive quickly. And you don't have the advantages of the weather.
Well, yeah, yes, that's a good point, actually. Very fair point. OK, so back to the walk then itself. You've obviously described very eloquently how the days differ as regards distances and so on. I suppose two things immediately come to mind. First of all, was there a temptation at any time to actually merge two of the days together if they're only sort of 6 or 7 kilometres? And the second thing, what was the highest point that you went over?
Well, in relation to the merging of days, I think that before I went and when I looked at some of the at how short some of the days were, it did seem to me that it might be a good idea to merge them. But pretty soon when I got there, I decided that I didn't want to do it. First of all, because as I said earlier, that the terrain was pretty challenging. And so although a few of the early days are very short, I did feel that I'd actually had a proper walk, even though I hadn't covered a great amount of ground. Secondly, because, of course, one of the nice things about doing a walk like this, and particularly if, as I was, you're walking on your own, it's nice to see familiar faces. And of course, if you start nipping ahead, then you don't get the advantage of that because, you know, the people you've chatted with outside the refuge the night before are going to be left behind. And thirdly, you know, I did want to relax. I didn't want to do it any more quickly than I had to do it. And so for all of those reasons, despite what I'd thought before I left, I pretty soon decided when I got there that I didn't want to be going any faster than I needed to go. Having said that, when I realized that I'd made a cock-up with my calculation of how many days were required to do the route, I did at that stage realize that I was going to either have to merge 2 days together at some point or alter my route to miss a bit out. And I definitely didn't want to do that. I was very keen not to miss a bit out. I mean, I'd gone all the way to Corsica and I didn't want to have to not do the last day into Conca or take one of the lower level alternatives that are sometimes available in order to make up some time. And so I did actually walk 2 days together. It was the day immediately after Visavona. Give me half a moment and I'll... Yeah, the day from Visavona, I walked directly from Visavona to Bocca di Verde, which was a walk of 24 kilometres in the end, but most people would walk that day in two stages. And it was fairly tiring, but it was certainly feasible. It was feasible to put those 2 days together. So that was the position in relation to the merging of things. I think the other thing you asked me about was the highest point. Well, the highest point of the walk is a place called Brèche du Capitelu. I mean, again, I don't know how it's properly pronounced, but it's 2,225 meters. One of my habits when I'm walking is, although I do look at the guidebook in advance, and on this occasion, indeed, I had it with me, I don't tend to read it in an enormous amount of detail. I tend to prefer to just let the thing unfold. So I didn't actually realize until afterwards that I had been to the highest point on the route because I hadn't been organized enough to be anticipating it in advance. But it was a very beautiful place. And I noticed that everybody seemed to stop there. And so I stopped as well. And, you know, there were a few of the familiar faces there when I arrived and some more of them arrived as I was sitting around. And we probably all sat around for about an hour, basically just enjoying the weather. And there were some very large birds that were flying about and trying to get pieces of people's sandwiches and just basically watching those and watching the lakes. There were a couple of beautiful lakes glistening in the sun some distance down the mountainside. And so I sat around there and watched those for a while and then eventually we all pressed on.
Well, you're certainly selling it to me. It sounds like I'm feeling very relaxed just listening to you.
It is quite fantastic. I mean, it's truly wonderful. And I really do hope to go back and do it again. I really do hope to go and do it again with my stove next time, but I definitely want to go back. But it's a truly fantastic thing. And honestly, Bob, I'm sorry now that I waited so long before I went to do it. Because as I say, in the end, it turned out that I could, you know, lessen the risk of lightning strike by going early in July. And the scrambling, which we haven't really spoken about yet, turned out to be, with one exception, much less terrifying than I had anticipated. So I'm sorry that I didn't go sooner. But I mean, again, as I said earlier on, it is a challenging route. It really is a challenging walk, I think, far more challenging than the stuff that I've done before. And so I think it's right to think pretty carefully about going to do it and make a sort of proper inventory of whether you're equipped to do it before just setting off.
Mm. Looking at the books again and the odd little reference books I've got here, they seem to suggest also, if you've got time, to actually take some diversions and pick off a few peaks, as it were, sort of
yes.
Munro style.
Yes.
Were you tempted to do that at all, or did you see anybody do that?
Well, I was tempted to do it. I didn't see people doing it. But then again, that may simply be because the people that I mainly spoke to were the people who sort of set off to just do the thing over a period of 15 days. I was tempted to do it. The reason I didn't do it was because, I mean, again, I kind of mentioned that I'd somehow managed to miscalculate the number of days that would be required for me to do the route. I think perhaps what I'd been thinking is, oh, well, you know, it's 14 or 15 days to do the whole thing, but some of the days are very short, and so therefore I'll probably run two or three of them together, and then I'll nip up this or I'll sort of nip up that. That's kind of probably, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, it's probably what I'd been thinking before I went. But as I explained a short time ago, when I got there, I realized that that's not how it was going to work. And so I found that, in fact, I didn't have time to go off and do those additional peaks. What I did speak to, there's several people I spoke to had, in fact, gone to visit. Now, there's a place, the name of which I've forgotten, that many people go to visit from Visavona. I think it might be the oldest village in Corsica. So it wasn't a peak, but it's a sort of place of historical interest. And quite a lot of people that I spoke to had actually broken the journey there and spent a day going off to do that, and then they'd continued. But the thing is, you know, of course, as I suppose we've all noticed when we've booked flights to go to places like this or to go out to the Pyrenees, it's often no more expensive to pay for a flight that enables you to come back after 17, 18 or 19 days than it would be to pay for a flight that brings you back after 14 days. And so next time I go, I will do the calculation properly, and I am going to allow a few extra days so that I can perhaps go and see that historical village and perhaps try to go up a couple of the peaks. And as I say, I mean, by the time we've actually got over there, it doesn't really cost very much more to spend a few extra days and do those things that turn it into a really very special holiday.
Mm, well, it's true all the time, isn't it? In the UK, sadly, it costs you virtually half the holiday to get out the country, let
Absolutely.
Alone do what you're trying to do. Yep. Now, talking about Visavona, the book that I'm reading, and certainly I've also heard from Chris Townsend's and Cameron McNeish's review of the trip, is famous for being a pig area, pig territory, which I understand is obviously
right.
a subject close to your heart.
Of course.
Because I mean, Chris lost his shoes, I think, to pigs rifling through his tent or whatever. Did you have any experience of that, or see anybody have any experience of wild pigs?
Well, I didn't see. I did see a couple of wild pigs. I didn't see as many as I'd have liked to see because, of course, I am kind of fond of pigs and piglets. And I did see a couple in the mountains on a couple of days. And in fact, I think it might have been at Bergerie de Londres that Chris is alleged to have had his sandals stolen by a pig in the middle of the night. Yes, there are quite a lot of pigs wandering around there, but there were no sort of problem. I mean, they weren't in any way aggressive. There weren't any sort of, they weren't sort of ravaging hordes of pigs dashing through the villages and carrying the tourists away. There's nothing like that. They all look very friendly, in fact.
I was thinking you weren't actually carrying very much food, though, for them to rifle through, I presume.
Oh, sorry. Well, no, I suppose that I wasn't. I did have bits and pieces of food, of course. But no, I didn't. And I was aware, I had it in my mind all the time. I'd read Chris's story, his account of having his sandals stolen in the middle of the night. And it was in my mind, in particular, it was in my my mind when I stayed at the refuge where it happened. But no, I didn't have that problem. I'm not sure how it kind of, I think that at the refuge where Chris's sandal was stolen, I mean, there's a fence there now, and it may be that it wasn't in place when Chris and Cameron did it, or if it was, it may be that the pigs burrowed underneath or something. But no, I didn't encounter anybody who had any difficulty or problem with pigs or any other creatures stealing their kit.
SAS pigs, obviously. They're from from Visavona, you've obviously replenished your yourself. You've had a nice hotel's rest and I'm sure pampered and rested and topped up with things. You're bound to be in the stride by now. Did you find mentally it became it was definitely a north section and a south section, but your approach to it was much more comfortable, and all the fear and all the little things that were worrying you had disappeared, and you topped up presumably with snacks and things there as well before you set off?
Yes, it's probably fair to say that. I mean, I wasn't quite as relaxed as I might otherwise have been on leaving Visavona, because that was the day when I actually walked two stages. And so, of course, I had to press on fairly quickly in order to get both of the stages out of the way. But I knew that I was embarking upon the part of the walk that was less vertiginous. And since I'm not particularly comfortable with heights, I felt happy about that. Excuse me, please. And I'd become used to the climate. And I read before I left that, you know, there are black widow spiders. And I knew, of course, that there would be scorpions in Corsica. And although I love wee creatures, I don't relish the idea of sharing a sleeping bag with them. And I had worried a little bit about whether my sleeping bag might fill up with black widow spiders and scorpions during the night. But I'd learned by the time I got to Visavona that that wasn't going to happen. And so, yes, in little ways like that also, I was able to relax and just settle into it. And yes, I mean, the second part of it was, I felt, less demanding physically than the first part, but it was still pretty demanding. It's just a slightly different sort of terrain, really, not perhaps as rocky and not quite as sharp, and the ups were not quite as steep, and the downs not perhaps quite as steep as those that I encountered in the first half.
The scrambling you were talking about then, where is there a particular area where it's all condensed together, or is the scrambling dotted throughout the whole walk?
Well, the scrambling, there may have been bits of scrambles in the second part. If there are, I don't remember them, although, you know, I could remind myself, I suppose, by looking through the guidebook. But basically, the scrambling comes mainly in the first part. On a day-to-day basis, there will be little bits where you need to, you know, go down a little tiny scramble, a steep, slabby bit of rock maybe. Nothing terribly demanding. And if it's thought that there might be any sort of difficulty, then frequently there will be a chain there to help. But there is one, as it were, sort of... the place that's famous for a scramble on the GR20 is the Cirque de la Solitude, which comes on, I'm just trying to work it out, I think it's on day five, and this is a huge bowl, essentially. It was day four. It's a huge bowl that you come to about 3 hours after out of Hort Asco, and you have to sort of climb down into it, and then you climb back up out of it on the other side. And that has a fairly fearsome reputation. And as a person who is nervous of heights, I felt that it deserved its reputation. It's definitely a place where it's necessary to be careful. And if you don't take your time, then unless you have no fear of heights, it's a place where it's possible to feel a little overwhelmed. But having said that, it's very well equipped with chains and ropes. Unless it's wet underneath, unless the rock is wet, then it's nice and grippy. And I think if you take things a step at a time, then there's no reason why it should be a problem, as long as you're careful. I mean, I realize I've sort of inserted about 1,000 caveats into that, but I do feel that, I mean, it's necessary to recognize that the Cirque de la Solitude can be a dangerous place. And so, yes, you do need to be careful, and you do need to give some serious thought to whether it's the sort of place you want to be before you start descending into it. As it happens, when I started into it, I hadn't even reached the first set of chains when a group of three people came up behind me, and it turned out that they were... they were Corsicans, in fact. They were Corsican people who... were very experienced walkers, and one of them, a chap called Freddie, has sometimes worked as a guide, and he must have noticed, you know, even though I was trying to appear confident, he must have noticed, I think, even from behind, that I had kind of the look of a nervous walker about me. And he just sort of stepped past and basically guided me down at the same time as he was guiding his friends down, which was great. And in fact, we all became friends, and over the course of the next few days, we walked together, and when I'd finished the walk, they invited me very kindly to stay with them in Bastia, which was incredibly kind, and I did stay there in Bastia. That was pretty brilliant. And so therefore I had the benefit of Freddie, you see, to help me through the Cirque de la Solitude. But when I was sitting in the refuge that night after the experience was over, you know, sipping on my pastis, because I'd moved on from beer to pastis by that stage, And I asked the other people what they'd thought of it, and nobody else, you know, seemed to have had any particular difficulties with it. I'm not aware of anybody who started the walk on the same day that I started it, who got to the Cirque and couldn't go on.
During that period of those 2 weeks, then, as much as you've mentioned the caveats about your confidence and abilities and so on, were you aware of anybody having any accidents or any issues?
I wasn't aware of any accidents, but I did. I did come across an English bloke, actually, about, I think it must have been the end of, perhaps, it was either the second or the third day. I met an English bloke at one of the refuges who told me that he was finding it more frightening, basically, than he'd expected it to be. He'd got a little bit lost that day. He'd gone up some rocky promontory accidentally and thought he was going to fall to his death. And I mean, clearly he hadn't, unless I was chatting with his ghost. But he decided that he wasn't going to go any further, and I didn't see him after that. And in fact, on the first night, on my first night when I was camping at Callanzana, there's a group of, I think it was four young English blokes camping in the next tent. And I saw them off and on over the course of the next couple of days, but then after that I didn't ever see them again, and I don't know what happened to them. I'm sure that they finished it safely, but I did wonder whether perhaps they'd found that it wasn't what they were anticipating and had gone off to do something else. So no, I'm not aware of any accidents, but I certainly came across one person, and possibly more than one person, who decided it was too demanding, and so they went off elsewhere. I mean, actually, having said that, I did come across a person who'd had a bit of an injury. There was a young Englishman again. He was at the refuge in Callanzana when I first arrived there, and he'd twisted his ankle very badly, so he'd had to leave his friends some days earlier and make his way down, and he was waiting in Callanzana for them to come. But I mean, one of the nice things about the GR20 and Corsica being a relatively small place is that, you see, there's, if you do have that kind of experience, if you do embark upon the walk and find that it's, you know, it's, you're not enjoying it, you know, or you are enjoying it, but you don't feel that you can continue with it, then it is possible to simply come off the route and go and do something else. It's not terribly difficult to do that. Certainly Paddy's book, and possibly David's as well, incorporates, as it were, escape routes that are described in relation to, I think, probably every stage. You know, it'll say, I mean, it's not so much directed at people, you know, who've changed their mind. It's more that they're included, I think, for in case the weather is dreadful, and so therefore it's not safe to be on the higher parts. But basically, there'll normally be something there to tell you how to get down to a lower point. And if you do walk down to a village, then I'm sure that it'll be possible to get, you know, a taxi, and you can go to one of the towns and spend your time doing something else.
The fact that you took a guidebook rather than a map, was the actual route sort of fairly well signposted? Was it easy to stay to that?
Well, it was very easy. I mean, I immediately add that, of course, I did it in July, so the weather was perfect and visibility was clear. But, you know, in common with, you know, that there's this series of the GR routes, the Grand Randonnée routes, and it's the same in the Pyrenees. They have these markings on rocks. You know, there's a sort of white stripe on top of a red stripe, and this tells you where the route goes. And they're marked on boulders and sometimes on the ground and on trees. And in on the GR20, it's very, very liberally sort of equipped with these markings. And at no stage did I have any difficulty at all knowing where I was supposed to go. I didn't take a map, I felt kind of bad that I hadn't taken a map, because I've never gone anywhere before without a map, even though, you know, I don't consider myself to be very good at maps. I'm not a natural map reader, although I do try. I hadn't actually been able to get hold of. I think there were 2 1-to-50K maps available, and I just hadn't been able to get hold of them in the time that was available to me. And so since everything I'd read had suggested to me that I probably wouldn't need one, I just took a compass so that at least I could know which direction I was walking in if mist came down. And I set off with the guidebook and knowing that the markings were there. But the markings were so frequent and clear that I didn't have any difficulty at any stage, which is unprecedented for me.
The trip itself, as you came to the end then, like a lot of walks, sometimes you have this big winding down and this sinking feeling that sort of takes place as you start to sort of see the end in sight, as it were. I'm sure you saw the coast and the views and so on. Did you feel, you know, sort of slightly disappointed it was coming to an end, or did you sort of feel elated that you'd got there safe and well?
Oh, well, it was the usual mixture of those two feelings. I was certainly elated because it was an achievement. I felt it was an achievement. It was very physically demanding, and it was something that I'd wanted to do but been a little apprehensive about trying for several years. And so as I was approaching Conqueror, I realized that I'd almost finished. And so, of course, I did feel an immense... I was elated. I was delighted to have done it. But at the same time, I was very much looking forward to being able to put up my feet and go and sip at some more pastis and perhaps find myself a hotel. And that was good. But there's always the feeling of, you know, being sad that you know, soon it'll be time to go home and get back to the drizzle and the sort of, you know, the mundane toil of every life and so on and so forth over here. So I always have mixed feelings at the end of any walk. But certainly it did feel like an achievement. And there was, basically I felt very happy to have finished.
And it's not a disappointing end, I presume. You could get to Conqueror and celebrate.
No, I didn't find it disappointing at all. I wandered down into Conqueror. The refuge that I stayed at the night before, the refuge Di Paliri, I think it's called, was really the most beautiful of very many beautiful places that I'd refuges that I'd camped outside over the period of the preceding 2 weeks. And it was absolutely staggeringly beautiful. Although I had an early night that night, but the other people who were staying there, I think, all sort of got round a table and shared some beers and probably not pasta, sandwiches perhaps, they all had a really good time, and there was, I think, pretty much a sort of festival atmosphere because it was the last night. As I say, I had an early night, and so I slept through that. I hadn't realised it was taking place. But the following day, I made my way down, there was the usual steep descent. But when I found that I suddenly emerged from a wood onto a road and realized that I was in Conqueror much more quickly than I'd expected it to happen. And then I was quite looking forward to finding my way down to, the bar where I could sit down and put down the rucksack and have a drink. And I sat down and I got a drink and I tried to chat with the local bloke and, the barman. And he told me how to find my way to a hotel. And I really enjoyed just sitting in the sunshine and soaking up the knowledge that I didn't have to carry a heavy rucksack anywhere in particular, once I'd found the hotel. It was a really nice afternoon. People eventually arrived. I think I was the first there, actually, at about 11 o'clock in the morning. It was a very early finish for me, and I'd kind of motored down as quickly as I could. So I was first in, and then other people came in. And then, over the course of the next few hours, a big bunch of people gathered around, and we sat together and had a bit of a chat and a drink and so on. And then most of the other people got on a bus and went off somewhere else. But I decided to stay in Conqueror. And an Italian man that I'd met at a refuge perhaps a week earlier, he was also staying in Conqueror, and so we spent a couple of hours together chatting over a beer and a pastis at the bar, and then I went off to get something to eat at one of the local restaurants, and then I went back to the hotel. I'd had quite a lot to drink during the course of the afternoon and the evening, and so I was probably fairly sort of blitzed by that stage, and I had a little bop along to my MP3 player in my room, and that was great. And then I sat outside and enjoyed the warmth of the evening and basically the beautiful smells coming up from the forest, and wished I didn't have to go home. It was a lovely, relaxing last day. I worried a bit about how I was going to get to where I needed to be the following morning, but apart from that, it was very relaxing. I enjoyed it a lot.
And just to conclude then, how did you get back? How was the transportation?
Okay, well, I'd been invited by the three Corsican people who I'd met earlier on the route had invited me to stay at their apartment in Bastia. And so therefore, what I decided to do was to get a bus to Bastia and then spend the night in Bastia and then travel by train from Bastia back over to Calvi the following day. And so I left the hotel at about 8 o'clock in the morning and walked down to the Jeet, which was a sort of pleasant 10-minute stroll, and got on the Jeet. I think it was €4 from the Jeet to the local village, Sant Lucie de Porto Vecchio, I think is where it was. And then we got I got onto a bus there with the Italian bloke and a couple of other people, and had a journey of about an hour and a half, perhaps it was, to Bastia. And then spent the evening in Bastia with the friends that I'd made earlier on. And then the following day, I got on a train from Bastia and went over to Calvi. And later in the day, I flew home. And that was that.
Well, nice and simple. I mean, would you advise people to allow a day at each end just to ensure there's no panic in getting to wherever you want to start and finish from?
I think that certainly it's a big advantage to have a spare day at the end if you can. This was a piece of good advice that I read in Paddy's book, but I didn't take, and I kind of really regretted it. Traveling home worked out fine for me in the end, but there was a bit of luck involved in that, really, because Paddy suggests, and I'm sure it's a good idea, that people who are going out there should make an attempt before you go to get an idea of how the public transport works at the end of the route. Because, of course, with it being a linear route, unless you're planning to fly back from a different part of the island, then you need to get back to Calvi, assuming that Calvi is where you went to in the first place. And it is important to know about the public transport. And as I say, I hadn't kind of done that, and it did work out, but it might have been different. It mightn't have worked. It mightn't have fallen into place. And I think that if you do have an extra day, then well, it might be essential, and at the very least it would be convenient to have that extra day. But I think the thing to do is to do the research before you leave England, really, or where it is you're going from. Do the research initially to find out where the trains go and how often they go and what times, and the same with the buses, so that you're not, you know, spending the last few days in a state of some anxiety about how you're going to get home.
There's nothing worse when you sort of see the end in sight, is there? Well,
absolutely.
Cheryl, thank you very much for all that detailed information. It's really padded out some of the books and notes that I've seen and read, and I'm sure many of the listeners will have enjoyed the practical and realistic information you've added in there, which has been really useful. You're obviously intending to go back and do it again, which I find quite interesting, and that in itself says a lot about the actual trip itself. Would you, I mean, you're a solo walker and you do a lot of solo walks, but you've also walked sort of in groups and socially as well. Would you say that it was a walk best undertaken on your own or with somebody or a group of people to share it with?
I'd say it's probably best to go with a group of people, really, because I enjoy walking on my own, but I also enjoy spending time with other people. And I mean, I think that this is a walk that, you know, would perhaps be lots of fun done on a slightly more sociable basis, basically, you know, so that you could have a bit of a laugh and a giggle together at the refuges in the evening. And that's my feeling. But some people just prefer always to walk on their own, in which case that would be fine for them. But if I were going back, then I'd like to do it with a group of people.
Well, finally then, as we do with these things, let's just have a quick 5 minutes chatting about gear, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
As you say, it was a laser competition, I believe, wasn't it?
It was.
And, yeah. Just a quick run through then, was it the standard sort of hiking gear, or had you sort of, apart from the cooking gear, left anything out of your rucksack?
I left a few other things behind. I didn't bother with the GPS because I didn't think I would need it, and indeed I didn't need it. I've mentioned already that I didn't take maps. I didn't bother with waterproof trousers either. I didn't think that I would need them, and I didn't need them. I'd normally have, in addition to a base layer, of course, you know, I'd normally have a mid layer and some kind of warm jacket and then a waterproof top. But I didn't bother taking a warm jacket either. And again, I didn't need that. What I did take essentially was, you know, from day to day walking, I took a pair of shorts and a T-shirt. I actually took two T-shirts, but next time I wouldn't bother taking two, because it's so easy to just rinse things through and dry them out on a rock overnight that I wouldn't bother with two walking T-shirts. I had a very lightweight fleece. that I've had for years. You know, one of those sort of smocky fleeces that's just got a little zip at the top. I took that, and I didn't need it during the day, but I used it in the evenings in the refuges, because with it being mountainous, I found that when the sun goes down in the evening, it goes very suddenly and it can get very chilly. So whilst it was never freezing cold, I mean, it did get quite cold, and the little fleece was very helpful. So I didn't bother with a warm jacket. I didn't have my cooking kit either, of course. I normally take a sort of Paramo Fuera windproof smock when I'm walking in this country, and in fact when I've been walking the Pyrenees. But again, I didn't bother, and I didn't need that either. I didn't take my bed socks or thick gloves or a map case. So I actually left out quite a lot of the things that I would normally take along with me. And with the exception of the cooking gear, I found that, you know, those had been good decisions, and I didn't need any of those things.
I'm surprised you didn't have a down jacket then for the evening. So I would have thought it would have gone in very, very chilly at night.
Well, no, I mean, it wasn't really. I mean, it was chilly, but it wasn't it wasn't chilly enough for me to need a down jacket. And I mean, having said that, I mean, I tend to run cool rather than warm, you know. And so I think that if I'd needed if there'd been a need for one, I'm sure I would have detected it. But no, I was perfectly happy with my little fleece. I mean, having said that, you know, most of the evenings I actually spent having something to eat in the refuge, and then, you know, perhaps sitting around for a little while and chatting with people before going back to the tent. But once I got into the tent, it was lovely and warm. You know, I suppose that the ground, of course, had absorbed a lot of heat during the course of the day, and I suppose that that radiated up, and I really wasn't cold.
Okay, so sleeping bag, sleeping mat?
Yes, I took a lightweight sleeping bag. Just let me see. I had a PhD Minimus, which is 520 grams. I've had it for several years now. It's very lightweight. It was absolutely perfect. Some nights it was so warm that I just basically pushed it down and lay on top. But on those occasions when it was chilly, it was warm enough almost all of the time. I've got into the habit of I carry a very light bivy bag with me all the time now. It's an Equinox Mummy, and it's only 188 grams. So I had that. It's partly so that if I'm having a drink in the tent, I don't have to worry if I accidentally spill it on the sleeping bag, because, you know, it'll just run off the bivy. I think there might have been one or possibly two evenings or two nights when I was just a little bit cold, perhaps when I was camping a little bit higher up, and on those nights I'd put that lightweight sleeping bag in the bivy, and then I was toasty warm. For a mattress, I actually took one of the short versions of the X-Bed down mat. It might sound a bit of an odd choice to take what people perhaps think of as a fairly sort of, you know, robust camping mattress to Corsica. And I've got a couple of Inchil mats, and I had been intending to take those. Those are lighter, and they're inflatable mattresses, thicker than Thermarests, because I've never been able to sleep comfortably on a thin mattress. But I found that both of my Inchil mats had developed a multitude of very tiny holes, and I spent several occasions kind of bucking around in the bath with the blaster things, trying to identify the holes and then patching them. And I just didn't manage to find them all and fix them all. So in the end, I bought and took this small X-Bed, and it was absolutely fantastic, because I hadn't anticipated, you see, how hard the ground was going to be. It just hadn't occurred to me that it was going to be baked clay, but it was baked clay. It was very hard, and so the mattress was perfect. And although it's a fairly robust mattress, it's still less than 600 grams. And so I was delighted with that. And because I always have, you know, those very tiny little Thermarest squares, the tiny little inflatable squares that you can use to sit on if you stop for a drink. Mm. I always take one of those. I mean, I think that other people make them, but mine happens to be a Thermarest. And I put my feet on that, you know, so that my feet didn't get cold, even though the mattress was only short. And yeah, that was my sleeping kit.
Brilliant. So no big sort of wardrobe of clothes there, no big great changes of clothes, just what, one set of dry and one set of clean, something like that?
Yes, well, I had one pair of shorts and two T-shirts for walking during the day. And as I say, next time I wouldn't bother with two T-shirts. I'd just take one. For the evening, I took a t-shirt, a very lightweight old silk t-shirt that I bought from Marks and Sparks thousands of years ago. I took that because it's very light and squishable. And I also took my zip-off terror pants. That's the ones, yes. I took some of those as well. I think they're the old-fashioned ones, but I've had them for yonks and I really like them. So I took those for the evenings. And I suppose I was, because they are the zip-offs, I was probably thinking that if I needed to swap shorts during the day, I could do that, but I didn't need to in the end. And they were perfect. So for the evening, I had the terror pants, this sort of very lightweight t-shirt and the very lightweight fleece. And I've got a very ancient heli t-shirt that I've had for 20 years that I always take to sleep in. At home, I would have some kind of fleecy, you know, bottoms as well, but I didn't bother. I just took the t-shirt and it was fine. That was that. I took four pairs of socks, you know, the short kind of ankle socks, Smart Wool Adrenaline Light Mini Crew is what I took. And I could have managed with three, and I probably could have managed with two. But my idea was that one of the pairs I'd be able to use for the evening. So I took four pairs of those. I was on my feet. I was wearing the rock lights that I've been using for walking in for several years, and they were absolutely fine. I mean, the only thing, they were fine in terms of being grippy, in terms of being light, in terms of providing enough support. In all of those respects, as they always have been before, they were absolutely perfect. Unfortunately, I better mention, because it does tend to keep happening, it seems, the soles started peeling away on each of the shoes, and I thought that this was a problem that they'd sorted out, but apparently not, because it was a brand new pair of shoes that I bought for the trip, and it worried me a bit that, I mean, as you'll appreciate, if the sole's coming off when you're on kind of rocky mountains, then, you know, you get a bit afraid that you're going to trip, but I didn't trip, and in terms of comfort and support, they were perfect. And I also took, you know, those things, Crocs, those
lightweight.
So I took a pair of Crocs for the evenings, and they were absolutely brilliant. I found that I wore them on the flight, I wore them in Nice, I wore them in the evenings, I wore them in the showers. On the couple of occasions that I went for a swim in a rocky pool, I had them on there as well. And they were just great, and they weigh virtually nothing. And they're a little bit bulky, but they don't take up loads of space. I think I might actually have clipped them onto the back of my rucksack, or perhaps I stuffed them into the back pocket, I'm not sure. But they were perfect, so I took those as well. And some knickers and a couple of running bras, and I think that was it in terms of... So I was going to say, I did take a very lightweight pair of gloves. I took my Tilly hat, which was perfect. I mean, happily, well, there was only one sort of rainy day. The rest of the time it was sunny and the Tilly was lovely. The thin pair of gloves I needed on the one kind of windy morning. And what I forgot to mention is I did, although I didn't take waterproof trousers, I did take, you know, the Berghaus Packlight smock. I took that. It squashes up to virtually nothing. And I wore it, I think, twice, and it was absolutely perfect.
Right. Okay. So just to quickly conclude then, what would you leave behind next time if there was anything at all? And what, apart from the cooking gear, should you have taken?
Apart from the cooking gear, I don't think there was anything else that I should have taken. I think, you know, it all worked out. And there's... Oh, sorry, that's not quite right. I'll tell you what I should have taken that I didn't take. Spare batteries. I hope that nobody else will make the same stupid mistake that I made here. I forgot on this occasion to take spare batteries, and that turned into a really big problem because it's very difficult to get them on the GR20. The only place that I could actually get them was at Visa Vona, which, of course, is halfway through the walk. And I'd realised my mistake, you know, during the sort of northern part. And I'd wanted to take, you know, those convenient little films that you can take with a lot of the little digital cameras these days. And I had to stop doing that because, of course, I was sort of going through my batteries at a great rate of knots. So, yes, sorry, that's what I should have taken. I should have taken plenty of spare batteries of decent quality. So I hope nobody else makes the same daft mistake. Mm. And the other thing, actually, I realised with the benefit of hindsight that I should have taken is I'd heard that that there's hardly any mobile phone reception there, and so therefore I didn't bother with a charger, and I almost didn't bother taking my mobile, but I did take it in the end. And then I found that although there isn't reception all over the place, I mean, there is reception in a couple of places, I mean, Hort Asco, for instance, and some other places. And I soon realized that as soon as there was reception, of course, I wanted to check my texts, and I wanted to send some texts, and then I wanted to add some money on, and the battery ran down quickly. So I should have taken a spare mobile battery too. This is something I've I've done in other places. You know, they're very inexpensive on eBay, and you just charge a couple up and stick them in your pocket, and there you go. So I should have done that as well.
Well, certainly I remember being a recipient of one of your messages and being green with envy that you were sitting somewhere fantastic and having a
yes.
cold beer, having just done some particular peak. It sounded
fantastic. I think it was probably that very place, actually, Hortasco. I think that's exactly where it was.
Mm. Just a very quick aside, and something that obviously is important to a lot of people these days is that from an environmental point of view. What are your suggestions, or what do people do regarding the toilet facilities? Did you take a toilet trowel, or do you use it just at the huts, or what?
Do you know, I don't think I did take the toilet trowel because I knew that I was going to be able to use the huts. I mean, basically, facilities exist at the huts. Even if you're not staying in the refuges, even if you're just camping outside, that you're able to go and use the shower. I think they've all got showers, and none of the showers are hot. You know, it's just sort of cold water that's, I suppose, accumulated from rainfall or something. And so they're absolutely freezing cold, albeit very refreshing once you actually get out and rub yourself down a bit. And toilets as well, there's sort of toilets outside, or sometimes there are little blocks, and so I just use those, and anybody can use them, whether you're staying at the refuges or not. So that's what I did, and it wasn't a problem.
Excellent. Great. Well, Shirley, thank you very much indeed for taking the time. This has been a fascinating content, and I'm sure many people have appreciated it. I've certainly had emails from people desperately waiting to hear this conversation. So,
not at all. It's my pleasure, and I hope that there's something useful in there, and that I hope it might encourage somebody else to go out and have an equally brilliant time.
It certainly sounds definitely one on our list to achieve, and I'd love to give it a go, and you certainly sold it to me. You're definitely big time. I suppose the next time I'm going to catch up with you actually will be in Scotland on the
yes.
TGO Challenge. Hopefully
extremely exciting.
Yeah, somewhere remote. So until we actually meet again and catch up with you and get some more interesting stories and adventures that's happened to Shirley, thank you very much for your time, and have some safe travels.
Thank you very much, and you too, Bob. Take care.
And that concludes part two of this podcast series about the GR20. My thanks to Shirley for taking the time to share it all with us so eloquently. For more information about Shirley's GR20 trip and others she has made, do visit her website for photos, detailed information, and a lot of outdoor inspiration. Her website is www.pwiglet.com, and you spell that pwiglet.com. So until next time, folks, safe travels, high peaks, happy hiking, and bye for now.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To hear more from our extensive free library, please visit the website at theoutdoorstation.co.uk.
You can now follow The Outdoor Station on Facebook, where we chat about each programme we produce, answer questions, and discuss future productions. Why not join us there?
This podcast is produced and hosted by theoutdoorstation.co.uk.